Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, again. Welcome back to the Vox Pop. This is a good day today because we have with us Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians. He's the best to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. Board certified in both areas, is also an assistant professor of medicine at Albany Medical College. Dr. Carcillo has been with CDRP since 2004 and is the current president and managing partner of the practice. He's the head guy. A graduate of the University of Scranton, he completed medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical interests include transplant nephrology and hypertension. Dr. Carcillo, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Well, I love when you come. But let me ask you this. You came the last time. We got a lot of calls, which we were already getting, 1-800-348-2551. But we didn't talk much about, you know, dialysis. And I know dialysis is big. You just opened up a dialysis center, haven't you?
We sure did. We opened up a brand new center on Washington Avenue. And it's a beautiful new center. It's a state-of-the-art facility, but it's a place that I've spent a lot of time working on design. And also, you know, with a new center, you want to bring into consideration the patient's experience. And that's one of the things that we talked a lot about when we were bringing the center into existence.
Now, what do you mean patient experience?
Well, you know, dialysis, as you may or may not know, is something that requires a lot of time, and it's a big lifestyle change for patients. It's something that can require, you know, 12 to sometimes 20 hours a week for patients. It's something that patients will need if the kidneys have completely failed, and it's something that we call end-stage kidney disease. So if you need to spend 12 to 20 hours a week somewhere, if it were me, and that's how I like to think of it. If it were me, you would like to go to a place where you would feel comfortable, where you would feel like this is a pleasant place for me to come, a comfortable place, a place where I'm going to get good care.
So now I know that it's possible to do dialysis in your home, right? I mean, why would people go to a center if they could, and especially if the government, I hate to say it this way, but if the government is paying, then why wouldn't you do it in your house?
It's a great question, and I think that home dialysis therapies are a great solution for patients who need that kind of treatment. It is interesting, though, that statistically, only about 10% of patients will choose to do home therapies. It's something that we go over extensively, and we feel fortunate enough to get exposure to patients before they need dialysis, before they come to the hospital for some reason. But if we are able to speak with patients in the office, one of the things that we talk about is, where would you feel most comfortable? Would you want to be at the center, having someone else take care of the treatment for you, or would you rather be at home? There are so many benefits to being at home, including just having the privacy of your own home, but, you know, having the autonomy and participating in your care is a big deal.
So when you get started, would you guys be able to send a nurse to train somebody how to do it at home?
There are some instances where we've had nurses come out to patients' homes. And across the board, we have the nurses come out to the patient's home to make sure that it's an acceptable environment to do the treatments. Once that's done, generally we have the patients train how to do the dialysis at our center. And then the patients come out to the home once they feel comfortable and we feel comfortable that they've trained appropriately.
So, Vince, is it all right to start taking some calls?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Love to.
We'll go to 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Lana to, no, I'm sorry, Annie in West Stockbridge. Annie, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Doctor, I've just been told that I need to go on a low oxalate diet. I've had a bad bout of kidney stones, and I'm just wondering if you can point me in the direction of some good resources.
But not before you tell us what oxalate is, Vince.
So the majority of patients that get kidney stones, and this is a very common thing, about 500,000 people or 500,000 people come to emergency departments across the country for kidney stones every year. So one of the most common kinds of kidney stones are formed from something called calcium and oxalate. So calcium, as you know, is one of your body salts. It's an electrolyte. Calcium makes your bones. And so calcium gets excreted into the urine, and we know that the kidney also excretes substances that will inhibit calcium from binding together with other things to make salts, which then become stones. And so oxalate is one of the things that comes together with calcium. And so if you are someone who overproduces oxalate for some reason, we want to try to get that down. One way to do that is with a low oxalate diet.
Okay. And so, Annie, you wanted to follow up on that?
Yeah, I was just wondering if there were any resources he could point me to, any studies, any diets per se that he knows of, any medical, centers doing research.
Sure. So oxalate, as you know, is found in a lot of fruits and seeds. So one of the resources that I will point you toward is actually we have a whole set of links on our website, and that's at www.cdrenal.com.
Cdrenal.com.
Yes, CDRENAL.com.
Wonderful.
Not only that, I take it, Annie, that you have written in low oxalate on the Google.
Yes, I did. I did a search, but, I just wanted to kind of narrow it down to somebody.
Well, you're right. Of course you're right. You never know.
Yeah, you never know. Okay, well, I appreciate it so much.
Bye,
thank
Anna.
You.
Bye.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros. Welcome back, Jim. You're on.
What medications are currently available to decrease the toxic effects of increased creatinine and PUN to possibly stave off dialysis?
Okay, but before we go, let us just say, before we give it to the doctor, that when we all go to the doctor, they do a full screening panel, and usually there's something that says bun on it, and there's usually something that says creatinine on it. Creatinine is the more important one, isn't it, Vince?
Both tell a story.
Okay.
And so as a clinician, especially as a nephrologist, we look at those things sometimes independently of one another and sometimes together. They do both tell us about kidney function. So this BUN that you'll sometimes see on your labs, if you get your labs, or I know a lot of primary care doctor and specialist offices will invite you to participate in patient portals now where you can log in on the computer and see your labs. So a lot more people are having exposure to seeing these types of numbers. So this BUN is something that's called blood urea nitrogen. So nitrogen is something that we get from proteins. So if you eat a big steak dinner, then you're going to have a lot of nitrogen that gets broken down into your blood. If you were to check a blood test just at that moment, then you would see that number would be higher, regardless of what your kidney function is. You're able to excrete those things well from your kidneys. So eventually they settle down to normal numbers, and that the normal number for blood urea nitrogen is usually in the single digits. So creatinine is something that's completely different. And again, this is something that we talk about as a marker for kidney function. Sometimes in the office, I'll talk about it as a watermark for kidney function. The higher it goes, the worse it is. The lower, the better. So, but it actually doesn't come from the kidneys at all. The creatinine is a byproduct of muscle metabolism. So that stuff actually is coming from your muscles. Every day your muscles are active and they make more of this stuff, which is simply a waste product. It goes into the blood, circulates around till it gets to the kidneys, and the kidneys flush it out. So you should be in balance. Every day making more, every day getting rid of more, and so your level should stay the same. On average, if you looked at the, normal patient's kidney function, that creatinine should be around 1.
Okay, now Jim, who has a penchant for asking good questions, wants to know what he should do. Are there medications in case your BUN and your creatinine are out of line?
There are not medications that specifically target those two elements in your blood to make them lower. There are sometimes medications that can make them higher, and that may or may not reflect kidney function and may sometimes just be a specific side effect of the medication. Chronic steroids, for example, will make your BUN higher. And there are some common medications like Bactrim, which is an antibiotic, which can make your creatinine a little bit higher. And generally, when those medications are stopped, those numbers return to normal. There are medications that we do use to prevent ongoing kidney damage. And a classic example of one of those medicines is a class of medications for blood pressure called ACE inhibitors. We use those medications in many people who have chronic kidney disease, specifically sometimes patients who have diabetes or patients who have protein in their urine. And we know that over time that those medications can help prolong kidney life.
Okay. Jim, we got to go. Thank you very much for your question. All right. Zach, take it away, and we'll be back in a moment.
Support comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. Nathan Litauer Hospital, proudly introducing the gastroenterology specialist of Litauer with Dr. Alvarez, Dr. Ramani, and Dr. Ramon, NLH.org. Northshire Bookstore, presenting Writer's Workshop with CNN's John Dudakis on Saturday, March 12th from 9 to 3:30 in Manchester, Vermont, northshire.com. And from Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts, for 79 years working to inspire curiosity, excellence, and integrity in students preschool through ninth grade. A good beginning never ends. PineCobble.org.
We are back, and thank you. We're really, really lucky to have Vince Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians in the studio to discuss nephrology and kidneys and all like that. Okay, Vince, let's take some more calls. 1-800-348-2551. If you want to get in, ladies and gentlemen, this is a great time. When we did the first round, all the phones were busy. But right now, we have two people on the line. I always like to tell you, be transparent here, to tell you what's going on. You have a good chance to get in right now. Let's go to Dave in Schenectady. Dave, you're on.
Okay, I would like to ask the doctor what he has heard about the effects of omeprazole, which is a medication for acid reflux, what he has heard about the effects on the kidneys, and how he would compare that to calcium or aluminum hydroxide or magnesium carbonate, all of them designed to lower acid so that you don't burn out your esophagus.
Great. Well, thanks for the call. You know, I know that there was a study that made the paper today talking about proton pump inhibitors, and, you know, they did see that there was maybe some association, at least, with chronic kidney disease. I don't know that there was a mechanism that's well described there, but something obviously that we'll be paying attention to moving forward. I think it's a good question for a number of reasons, and you bring up a number of alternative medications. And this is the case, you know, from time to time. You know, physicians have choices, patients have choices, and all medications, I would point out, are not perfect. And many of them have side effects, and many of them have consequences that are not necessarily side effects, but unintended consequences. So, you know, those medications that you mentioned, I'll just point out, are also, you would think of calcium as a pretty safe thing, you know, and Tums, which has been used for heartburn before, is calcium carbonate. So this is a relatively safe medication. But in some instances, patients can hold on to that calcium, can have very high calcium levels that can cause kidney problems. The other medication you mentioned, the aluminum hydroxide, this is something that we had used aluminum-based products in the past for dialysis patients. Dialysis patients are unable, in most cases, to excrete phosphorus. And so we would bind that phosphorus up to protect patients with aluminum. Unfortunately, and this was many years ago, aluminum was then deposited in the bones and caused bone disorders. So no medication is without its baggage. And I think it's important to point that out.
Well, let me just add to the perplexity of Dave's very good question. And that is that there, for example, if you have a hiatal hernia, and you have, you know, this reflux that can be so dangerous, as you say, in burning out your esophagus. I certainly know all about this whole issue, or I think I do anyway. What happens is that they can repair your, they can repair that hiatal hernia so that you don't get the reflux anymore. And I know my gastroenterologist doesn't like the idea of doing that surgery because surgery has its own issues, as we can tell you. But, yeah, surgery is another alternative.
What may I ask what the doctor or you, Alan, would recommend to take for acid reflux? Right now what I'm doing is I'm taking omeprazole for about 5 or 6 days. And then that kind of allows the esophagus to heal up enough so that if I go off of it for a week or 10 days, it doesn't seem to give me a lot of heartburn. And then when the heartburn starts to come back, which it usually does, then I go on another 6 or 8 days of omeprazole.
Well, you know, what I would like to do is to tell you that I try not to give out specific instructions to patients over the lines like this, not knowing you well, not knowing your history and that kind of thing. But what I'll tell you is that, you know, this is an extremely common problem and a problem that has been around long enough that there are a lot of over-the-counter medications for it. But it sounds like it's something that, you know, if you're taking omeprazole, this has been prescribed to you. Now, that's either through your primary care physician or a gastroenterologist. If it's a problem that you've had for quite a while and you're concerned about the medication, maybe not sure of how serious the problem is, there are ways that gastroenterologists have of determining how serious and if there's any damage in your esophagus from that. And that's where I would point you in the direction.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Wait.
We're lucky to have you guys.
Well, we're lucky to have him. That's for sure. So here's my thing. I can tell you this much. If you keep the weight off, it seems to put less pressure. It seems, at least to me, and this is only Alan talking, not a doctor, but it seems to take the pressure off, the reflux. At least that's what I find. So you might try that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Great show.
Yep. Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Wendy in Pittsfield. Wendy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband just started home dialysis, and he's also on the list for a kidney transplant. But how long or how far away are we from growing a kidney or 3D printing one or putting DNA into some form of a kidney and making it function?
Well, thanks for the call. It's a great question, and it's so exciting to think that that's maybe not science fiction anymore. So I do not believe that we are all that close, but I wouldn't be surprised if we were close within the decade. You know, this is something that I know there's ongoing research on, and we don't have any artificial kidney of natural sense. As I think you're talking about is creating tissue. What we are much closer to than ever before is a wearable kidney. So we'll call that an artificial kidney, but this is a device. And so they're working on this, and they've been working on it in California for quite some time. And I saw a presentation recently that they're close and they're ready to start some clinical trials with it.
Wow.
So something to look forward to that's maybe much closer than actually creating a tissue kidney.
So we got two kidneys, right?
We have each person is born with two kidneys for the most part. There are some people who are born with just one.
Okay. If your twin brother comes to you and says, well, we have the same DNA and everything, my kidney is failing, should I give him one? Of mine.
Another great question, and it brings so many stories to mind. The first successful kidney transplant done in the 50s was done between two identical twins.
Sure.
And it was done without any immune suppression.
By the way, this is a hypothetical question. I do have an identical twin. But this does not happen. But go ahead.
So, you know, the question of should someone donate a kidney is, I think, a much deeper, a much more complicated question, something that we explore all the time with people. And many times when someone needs dialysis, there are a lot of noble family members or friends or spouse that would like to donate a kidney. In the case of identical twins, you're not worried about blood type, right? And these are much more genetically similar organs. And that means that they're much more, or they're much less likely to reject. But
on
even
the other hand,
making the decision is something that's very complicated.
Not to bother you about this, but on the other hand, if one twin had a bad kidney, there might be something in that DNA or whatever that would predict that the other twin would have it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, depending on what type of kidney failure it is, it may be genetically inherited.
Yeah. Okay, Wendy, is that okay?
No, I was going to ask, how can you get on the clinical trial for the mechanical kidney?
Well, what you can do, we do have some links on our website that I mentioned earlier.
Give it again, will you?
It's www.cdrenal.com, cdrenal.com. And so there are links to National Kidney Foundation, which would have more information about clinical trials. And we have some other links, too. Are you local to the Capital District?
Well, in Pittsfield, it's an hour away. It's
okay, so not too far away. Now, you say your husband just started home dialysis?
Right.
Which I think is a great option, and so the nephrologist who takes care of him would have more specific information if they're recruiting patients for trials right now.
Well, they don't seem to be. That's why I was asking.
My guess is, especially since the company that I'm aware of that's been working on it is across the country, it's likely that they would be doing their clinical trials close to home.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. That was a good question. An ancillary question here is, who would be a good candidate for home dialysis, and when would it be better to have treatment at a dialysis center?
Oh, excellent question. One that we come across, I won't say every day, but almost every day. And so when I talk to patients about dialysis therapy, it's a big transition. It's a big life change. And so I want to make sure that patients are comfortable with the decision and know what their options are. A patient who is a good candidate for home therapies, it doesn't take a lot. You can do home therapies if you live by yourself. You can do home therapies if you're elderly. All you need is to be able to participate in your care. And we can do an assessment. We, like I said before, we have nurses come out to patients' homes and make sure that the environment is appropriate. But I would say most people are capable of home therapies, and I think it's a great option.
Okay. Let's go to John in New Paltz. John in New Paltz, you're on.
Hi. Just a quick question about kidney stones. I thank you for taking the call. It's my understanding that kidney stones basically are like precipitates out of a supersaturated solution on a chemical level. And so two ways to address that is, one, reduce what's precipitating out, or dilute the solution so it's not a supersaturated solution. And that if people hydrated, they would avoid a vast majority of kidney stones.
Well, wow, John, thanks for the call. Are you a chemist?
Well, no, I took chemistry.
I like that, supersaturated solution. So,
yeah.
You know, as I alluded to before, in the urine, there are a lot of different components, and some of those components are electrolytes. Now, there are some things that we had a caller earlier that talked about oxalate. Oxalate's one of the things that calcium can bind to make crystals. Those crystals can get bigger as they grow in a solution and form stones. There are other things that are formed in the urine, like citrate, that actually inhibit those things from coming together. So there's a whole process going on in the urine. But you're right. It's like they say, right? The solution to pollution is dilution. So
okay.
if you are well hydrated, and you know, the current suggestions is drinking about an ounce of water for every pound of body weight that you have.
Wait. So if I weigh, I do, 134 pounds, That means I need 134 glasses of water every day? No.
134 ounces of water.
Ounces of water. And 12 ounces, 12 goes into 100. Okay, gotcha. All right. That's still a lot of water, isn't it?
It's a lot of water.
Right.
And so that would be the higher end. You know, there are some suggestions, you know, half an ounce to an ounce. So somewhere in that range.
You drink 11 glasses of water a day?
I don't have enough time to drink that much water.
Okay. Thank you, John, from Newport.
Well, you're welcome. And I got to tell you, I'm drinking currently probably a gallon or so a day almost. But the best thing about hydration, Alan, I got to give time not to you. When I had the reflux, I reduced and the reflux went away. So
really?
That's the
Let me get that straight. Let me get that straight. You reduced the amount of water you were drinking and the reflux?
No. I reduced my size. I reduced my physical size.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the reflux
Nothing
went
like
away.
It.
Have stones been a problem for you?
Yeah, I had stones. I had a small family of five that I found on straining them, and I have the family somewhere at home somewhere in a jar. But my dad had them too, and it was his initial thought about the hydration, and he was an MD.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about it from a chemical level, and it seemed to make sense. But in any case,
there
the
are
amount
some
of water, like he says, we're supposed to have versus what we take in, it's extreme.
Yes.
So I expect if a study was done, if we were all hydrated, there'd be a hell of a lot less stones in the world.
Well, some basic things that you can do. Yeah. Hydration is the big one, but many people suggest decreasing the amount of animal protein you take in and also decreasing the amount of sodium that you take in your diet.
Right.
I'm going to ask somebody from the front office to bring me a glass
That's
of water.
Good.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. There are two people on the phone. Means there are three open ones. 1-800-348-2551. And we are talking to Dr. Vincent Carcillo. He's just great. Okay, let's go to Maggie from Stone Ridge. Maggie, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Maggie.
Thanks for my call. Well, first of all, I just want to say, I ended up in the emergency room in June in end-stage renal failure, which I was unaware of. I knew I'd had some kidney issues a couple of years ago, but the numbers had started to come back. I missed my physical last year, which, okay, there's an advertisement for getting your physical every year, and somewhere in the last 2 years, my kidneys ended up failing. And so I was faced with having to start dialysis. And when I started dialysis, I was offered the options of the peritoneal or the hemodialysis, peritoneal being home, hemo being blood in the center. And honestly, you know, I'm only 52. I have help at home, and the peritoneal was a really interesting option. I went with the hemo more for the support. It was a new thing for me. They take my blood every month. They check all my levels, my phosphorus, my potassium. And if I have questions or concerns or my fistula isn't acting right, I have a resource right there 3 times a week. So that's just one opinion on why I chose one over the other. But that wasn't my question. My question is about the diet. I mean, that's been probably my hardest thing to adjust to is the diet restrictions. Mm. Being in end-stage renal failure, and, you know, I've begun the process of a transplant, but it's mostly my phosphorus that I'm struggling with. I am taking Foslo, which is a phosphorus binder. It was upsetting my stomach some, so I have tried to find a balance between the Foslo and Tums, but then my calcium went too high. So is there any... you know, I feel like I have no variety in my diet, and that's been a huge struggle. Do you have any suggestions on how to find more balance in your diet in end-stage renal failure and not blow your potassium or phosphorus off the charts?
Well, I think maybe I do. And let me just start off by thanking you for sharing your experience. Because I think that's very interesting, you know, and we do see that. Like I had mentioned earlier, we love to have patients in the office so that we can talk about dialysis options when we know kidney function is declining. But sometimes we see patients for the first time in the hospital, and it's at the end stage. And so it's difficult, and it sounds like you may have struggled with it a little bit too. Now you're forced to make a lot of decisions for yourself and you don't have a whole lot of time to do that. So
exactly.
It sounds like you came through it great, and I'm glad to hear that. And, you know, home dialysis was an option for you. It sounds like you learned about peritoneal dialysis and hemodialysis. Peritoneal is dialysis that's done through the belly where you don't see any blood, for those who have never heard of that before. But what I would tell you is that I think that that experience is a common one. You didn't have a lot of exposure to what your options were, and you chose the option that you felt was most comfortable for you, which was in-center dialysis. What I would tell you is, moving forward, as you're exploring the transplant option, but I would say home dialysis is still an option for you.
But and on diet, Vince, she can go to a dietitian, can't she?
Well, she doesn't even have to, because okay. at the dialysis unit, and you are from
Stone Ridge.
So, Kingston.
What's that?
I go to the Kingston Dialysis Center.
Kingston Dialysis Center. So one of the things that dialysis centers try to be is comprehensive for the dialysis patient. So there is a dietitian at I know every dialysis unit that I've ever worked with. So there should be someone to help you through those day-to-day options. Now, do you have diabetes?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Thank God.
Well, yeah, you're in many ways you're right, because because diabetics have dietary restrictions already, and then we add the sodium restriction and the phosphorus restriction, and you're right. There are sometimes so many restrictions that it gets difficult to know what can I put in my mouth. One of the things that across the board we want dialysis patients to do is take in a lot of protein. And so, you know, safe forms of protein are the things that you normally think of, that it would be on the food pyramid, chicken and eggs and that kind of thing. But, you know, the foods that have high phosphorus, things like nuts and dairy and stuff like that, that can be a challenge. As long as you're taking your phosphorus binders, you can work with your dietitian. Phosphorus, and you brought that up, it's interesting to know that of the many things that dialysis can do for us in terms of cleaning the blood, things that we mentioned before, like this blood urea nitrogen and creatinine, potassium, one thing that the dialysis fails to do effectively is to eliminate phosphorus. So we have to do that with the diet.
Okay, Maggie, got to let you go. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Zach, take it away.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive cardiac care for heart disease, the leading cause of death, and education on recognizing warning signs. EllisMedicine.org for more information. Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions, including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, Raynaud's, and eczema, UVA and UVB sun protection. ProtexGloves.com. Flurry Lumber, Route 10, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing information and advice for sprucing up current or adding new decks, from exotic hardwoods to composite decking, offering delivery, flurrylumber.com. Tom McRae, Edward Jones Financial Advisor on University Drive in Amherst, Massachusetts, member SIPC. Edward Jones, making sense of investing, edwardjones.com/Tom McRae. And from the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting information about local research during monthly science lecture series at the Discovery Center, featuring the world of mosquitoes on Thursday, March 17th at 7 p.m., albanypinebush.org.
And we are back with Dr. Vince Carcillo. He is terrific. He's the head man at the Capital District Renal Physicians in Albany, New York, and in Saratoga, and all over the place, right, Vince? Where your facilities are all over.
We have expanded quite a bit in the last few years. We have an office in Albany on Hackett Boulevard, but also an office on the Ellis campus and in Saratoga as well, on One West.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Jerry in Northampton. Your turn, Jerry. Go.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't mean to veer too far off from the topic, but when I tuned in earlier, there was a gentleman speaking about medication and acid reflux.
Yep.
And at one point, I was on medication for that. It was famotidine, I believe. And what I did, I agree with Alan, that the exercise and weight loss was very important. But something that very much helped me was also going gluten-free, at least as much as possible, cutting it out from my diet. And that really did help me having all the problems I had that I had before.
Okay, I'm sorry. I missed that, Vince. Cutting out what of your diet, Jerry?
Gluten.
Oh, gluten. Interesting. Interesting. Okay, Jerry, that's very helpful. Thank you for adding it. Appreciate it. Okay, we'll go to Deborah in Olive Bridge. Deborah, you're on.
So at the same moment Maggie from Stone Ridge called in, I called in with almost a redundant question. However, my husband, who's been diagnosed in stage 4, is pre-dialysis, and everything that the doctor just mentioned that is good to eat, a dietitian told my husband he absolutely cannot eat. So while I'm watching him debilitate with this terrible disease, and despite that, I just want to mention that he gets up every day and makes himself go to his job, which is remarkable to me. But he's starving himself to death. And at this point, he's surviving on 2 or 3 staples, which, in my opinion, is devastating other processes in the body.
So what's he eating, Deborah?
He is surviving basically on apples, a product by Nestle called NovaSource, and shredded wheat and rice milk.
So Deborah, is your husband diabetic?
He is not.
Okay. So one of the things that was a kind of a classic piece of information or advice for patients who have kidney disease is that you should restrict protein in your diet.
Yes.
I am not restricting protein in the diet for my patients with chronic kidney disease at this point. And I think many patients who do that, who eventually require dialysis, start dialysis with very low stores of body proteins.
Mm-hmm. There are, I don't think he has any.
Mm. So there are dietitians and dietitians who specialize in patients who have renal disease. And I would seek out that that dietitian in your area. Or even travel, if you needed to an area close, you know, as close as possible to see a renal dietitian to get more specific advice. But, you know, what I'll tell you is that many patients, almost across the board, patients who have advanced chronic kidney disease tend to hold on to salt and water. So sodium restrictions of 2,000 milligrams a day tend to be helpful almost above all else. But again, I'm not restricting protein in most of my CKD patients.
But I think it's a great idea, Deborah, to get some good advice from a dietitian. Well worth the effort.
Yes. Specifically someone who sees kidney disease patients.
Yeah. Okay.
They all differ, and that's been his problem,
problem.
In this journey. Mm. There's a lifestyle center in Wildwood, Georgia. Mm. For kidney disease that we considered, and they teach people how to shop and how to prepare foods and how to eat almost what they were before, minus the sodium and the potassium and phosphorus. But, you know, that's a long way from New York.
Well,
so,
that's
but
true.
That was my interest, is that you mentioned protein, you know, because we have a small farm, so... To the outside world, you know, we eat well. We seek organic foods, but all the things that would be good for me are not good for him.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, and it's a great call. What I can do without giving you kind of more specific instructions for him as an individual is I would refer you to, we have links on our website that have dietary information for chronic kidney disease patients.
Want to give that again?
I can give you the website again. It's okay. www.cdrenal.com. That's CDRENAL.com.
And CD stands for Capital District.
Capital
right?
District.
Just in case people having memory.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. Okay. Thank you.
And thanks so much for calling in.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's great. And let's go to, let's see, I guess that's Mike in Olive Bridge. Mike?
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I was wondering if the doctor could talk a little bit about polycystic liver disease I know it might be a little bit off topic, but sometimes the two of them, kidneys and the liver, are tied together with the cyst and stuff like that. And if you have any dietary advice or anything.
Sure, Mike, and thanks for calling. Most of the time that we are talking about the same or similar disease process, patients who have polycystic kidney disease. What's polycystic kidney disease? It's generally a disorder where patients make a lot of cysts, and cysts are like bubbles in the tissue. And so in each kidney, you start making a lot of bubbles, and those bubbles compress out the good or functional kidney tissue, which over time makes the kidneys quite large, sometimes uncomfortable, and can make the kidney function decline. It's one of the reasons in the United States and other places where patients end up needing dialysis. That process is not unique to the kidneys, and many patients who have polycystic kidney disease also start to develop cysts in the liver and also the pancreas.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as dietary advice, almost across the board for patients with polycystic kidney disease, I find many of them to be salt sensitive. And so if those patients have hypertension, many times we can treat the hypertension with a sodium restriction. Again, I generally restrict to 2,000 milligrams in a day.
How much is that? How much is 2,000 milligrams?
As far as
trying to give us an idea about if you're putting salt on food, how much is 2,000? 2,000 milligrams.
The best way to get to 2,000 milligrams is, number one, to stop using the salt shaker altogether.
Yeah.
And to stop eating fast food, because, you know, one serving of fast food and you're already over 2,000 milligrams.
That's the Allen way. Okay. Thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it.
If I could just ask one more question.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, mine is the reverse. I don't have, actually, there's only one cyst on the kidney, but there are multiple cysts in the liver. So I was wondering if there's any further advice that the doctor might have for that particular, you know, setup.
Yeah. Not with respect to the liver disease, unfortunately.
Okay, Mike, got to go. Thank you. We'll go to Liz in Hudson. Liz, go.
Hi, yes. My husband had a kidney transplant about 7 years ago. And he's had bouts of chronic gout, and the prescription he's been given has been prednisone. But one, we worry about long-term consequences of he's already taking the Medrol and, like, increasing the doses for his whole life. He's a young man, and we wonder if there's other things, other prescriptions. I know that there have been out there that can maybe be prescribed, but there may be interactions because of his other medications he's on. Or there's other recommendations to keep the gout away, since it seems to be a chronic thing and it's impacting his lifestyle.
Sure. So the incidence of gout is quite high in transplant patients, and prednisone is one way of treating it. I heard you say that your husband is taking Medrol. So he's already taking some steroids. And steroids, again, we had mentioned earlier in the program that all medications have their baggage, and steroids certainly do as well. So there are going to be risks with the Medrol and the prednisone.
And, but if I could just interrupt, I've heard like Allopurinol, he had taken it once. He got like violently ill, and they were saying that actually, you know, he shouldn't be taking it. But I know some other family members have had success with like a one dose thing, and it takes it away, and I was just wondering if there were other medications that we could explore, because it seems like the prednisone takes a little while to take effect, and it seems to have less effectiveness.
There are other medications to explore, and what I would tell you is it is a complicated subject, because all of those medications, especially in a transplant patient, have to be looked at specifically for drug-drug interactions with the immunosuppression medications.
Yeah.
Thank you, Liz.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Liz.
Let's go to Michael or Michelle. I'm so sorry. Michelle in Newburgh, go.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on the discussion about the low oxalate diet. I've had kidney stones for 15, 20 years and have dealt with them. And I've found one book that has been really, really helpful, and I thought maybe I could give that information
go
to
ahead.
You guys. It's called the Low Oxalate Cookbook. Book 2, and it's put out by an organization called the VP Foundation. The reason why I like this cookbook is because it has a whole section on testing that they've done of oxalates in certain foods, and it breaks it down by categories. So it's really helpful in terms of coming up with recipes, coming up with your grocery lists, and what to buy, what not to buy.
Okay, so give us the title one more time, Michelle. We're running out of time here, and I really want to get as many people in as possible. Go ahead.
And then I have a quick question, if I can squeeze it in. It's called The Low Oxalate Cookbook.
Volume 2.
Book 2.
Okay.
Yeah. So my question has to do with potassium citrate. I didn't find this out until more recently in the last year about how you can sort of combat the crystals that you build in your kidneys with potassium citrate. So one of the things my doctor prescribed was a prescription for potassium citrate, which helps keep, you know, the oxalates at bay. Mm-hmm. And there's another way that you can do that, and that's through lemonade. And I'm wondering if you've heard what the difference is between the two, taking a prescription for potassium citrate or drinking what he recommended was Crystal Light lemonade because it's high in potassium citrate in terms of, like, delivery and how that works.
Vince?
Sure. So, yes, and potassium citrate, the key there is the citrate. It's not so much the potassium that's the most helpful. It's the citrate. And as we had talked about a little bit with one of the other callers, there's a whole chemistry set going on in the urine there, and there are things that want to come together that make crystals, and there are things that try to break crystals up. Citrate's one of the things that breaks crystals up. So any way that you can, you know, if you're someone that has an issue with kidney stones, citrate, in some cases, can help prevent future stones. Not in every case, but in some cases it can. And so whether you get it from citric acid from natural sources, lemonade being one of
them.
Or
sucking on a lemon.
Or taking a lemon or other forms that you can get citric acid in, or taking it as a pill form. Either way would be supplement.
Michelle from Newburgh, thank you for your call.
Thanks,
Let's
Michelle.
Go to Gene in Saratoga. Gene, it's got to be fast. Go ahead. Gene. Hello, Gene. Hello, Gene. Now, look, if your radio's on, you've got to do it through the phone. Forget about the radio, okay? Go ahead, Gene. What do you got?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I can hear you.
Don't do it through the radio. Do it through the phone. Go ahead.
Try it. Hold on a second.
Yeah, I knew it. I know my stuff. Okay. Oh, Gene. Hello.
Gene.
Hello, Gene. Can't hold on anymore. So sorry. Let's go to Joan in Rhinebeck. Joan, you're on.
Hello. Yes.
Go. Hi, Joan.
Yes. My question is, do we know the causes of preeclampsia and what are the side effects afterwards?
So as far as the causes, I mean, this is more of a question for your OBGYN doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I can tell you is that this is something that generally happens later in the pregnancy. Sometimes kidney doctors do get asked to come in and comment on cases when there's a lot of protein in the urine. But again, a complicated subject that mm-hmm. can involve other disease processes too.
Joan, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for
Thanks,
the info.
Thanks, Joan.
Yeah.
Thanks,
okay,
bye-bye.
We only have 1 minute, and I wanted to use it if we can, just on the caller that we had to hang up on because whatever was going on was going on. Was about if you have type 2 diabetes, are you not a candidate for any of these treatments or dialysis, for example?
No, absolutely not. It's the type 2 diabetes is the most common cause, or diabetes in general is the most common cause of kidney disease requiring dialysis in the United States. And those patients almost always are candidates for dialysis.
Well, we are just about out of time. And everybody, thank you. And Linda from New Paltz, I'm so sorry we couldn't get to you, but I think it's amazing, Vince, we got to most of them.
Whew.
And there were a lot of people up there.
Great calls.
I want to thank everyone who called in. Also thank our very good friend, Dr. Vincent Carcillo, for joining us today. Underwriting support for Vox Pop comes from Brattleboro Retreat, offering specialized trauma, mental health, and addiction treatment for police, fire, military veterans, EMTs, and corrections personnel, brattlebororetreat.org. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. He's terrific, too. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I don't want to tell you what happened, but she was in an ice skating competition the other day, and she did very well. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.